Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Our first annual seed and start fair called Free the Seeds is Saturday, March 19th at Flathead Valley Community College from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. We'll have 18 workshops, 30 booths, 2 films, lots of kids' activities, 2 roundtable discussions on food resiliency for our community, and lots of seeds and starts for sharing and swapping. Come one, come all. For more information, check out freetheseedsmt.com or check us out on Facebook. You can also call 406-471-0022. It's going to be a great time.
Welcome to the show today. I am super excited to introduce my guest who I met at the farmer's market last summer, and I finally think have convinced that she has a lot more to offer and teach us than she realized, and so she's consented to come on today and share her knowledge about something I'm super excited to learn about, and I think listeners will too. So from Planet Bee Harvest, welcome Pamela Lund.
Hey, Jackie. Glad to be here.
Well, I am super excited to have you because, as my listeners know, I am the sunflower girl. And you're going to talk to us a little bit about sunflower greens, which is a little bit different, and some other things. So do you want to start by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. You know, it was fun to meet you at the Kalispell Farmers Market. And I know when we met, I said, you know, this is my first year ever doing any sort of gardening at all. And I just wanted to jump in, you know, head first and start with the farmers markets. So just for everybody listening today, everything I say is based on one season of experience. However, I think it might be helpful for folks who are thinking about getting started gardening to learn what I learned the first year and maybe a little bit closer to the starting phase. So we'll be able to have some empathy for those who might be hesitant to jump in and share what advice I can.
Yeah, I think we're actually going to learn more from you than we do from a lot of other people, because that first year is crucial and you're going to inspire us. And you're also going to tell some people about something they probably never even knew was an option. So I do always like to start the show asking about your very first gardening experience. You know, were you a kid, an adult? Who were you with? What'd you grow? Like, what was your first gardening experience?
Yeah, you know, when I was a kid, I lived about 20 minutes south of San Francisco near Half Moon Bay, California. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at that time, and in fact, it still is, it was very much farmland. So, you know, they grew a lot of brassicas, Brussels sprouts and cabbages and things like that. They're well known for their pumpkins, so was surrounded by those. But my family wasn't a big gardening family. My mom came from Sweden and didn't come to the United States until she was in her early 20s. And she grew up near lots of farms. So I think her bent was more being a city girl and getting away from that. So we really didn't have a lot of that around, although we did have a small yard. However, we went to the local farm store in Half Moon Bay, and I picked up some seeds, just with, you know, the seeds that had pretty pictures on the front. That was my criteria at the time.
Me too, and still today.
Yes, that's true. Now they're really amazing. You know, like Baker Heirloom Seeds has these most amazing illustrations on their packets now. But so I picked up some carrots and probably some other flowers and didn't really pay much attention to gardening best practices, mainly just thought, oh, you know, you just sprinkle these on the ground and they grow. So I sprinkled my seeds on the ground and didn't see anything for a while. And as a kid, you don't really have the same sense of time as you do as an adult. So I forgot about them. And then all of a sudden, I don't know, a month later or whatever it was, I noticed these fronds peeking out of the soil where I had sprinkled the seeds. I was like, oh, wow, cool. What are those? I pulled one up and it was a carrot. And I just thought that was magic, you know, as a child, that you could put something on the ground. And, you know, I don't know if you know the area around Half Moon Bay and south of San Francisco, but unless you're preparing the soil, it's not the best for growing. So it was really a miracle that anything grew there at all. So that was really my first experience. And then, you know, just being around all the other farmers, we had this woman, I believe her name was Mrs. Lauder, and she came around selling her home garden produce to the neighbors in her little VW bug. So, you know, that was for me always a treat, you know, loved artichokes and really got to love vegetables. But other than that, after that experience, I didn't have much, if anything, to do with gardening for years until I started growing microgreens for myself at home, just for my own use. So that was really my first, with a long gap, experience in gardening.
Nice. Oh my goodness, I'm totally picturing this little children's book of Mrs. Lauder driving around in her VW bug with her produce. That sounds so cool. Okay. Do you want to tell us what organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening means to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's, to me, I think about, and it was funny, you know, this is just the way I think, and now I know there's a whole discipline around it, but it's like, you know, looking at the whole ecosystem of the garden, you know, what things work, what things don't work, how do you do the least intervention to get the best results? And I don't have very much experience yet with this, but just from a mindset, that made the most sense to me, you know, that you would want to work with the environment, work with the natural elements that you have in the local environment, and then, you know, experiment and play and figure out, you know, what is going to, you know, we're always intervening as gardeners. You know, it's not like we, you know, I'm looking to have wild forage out there that I go out and pick. So, you know, balancing that intervention with what the garden wants to do, I think, is my, you know, incoming mindset. And then I find out that there's a whole permaculture movement and lots of information and folks that have been doing this for years. So I've just started to kind of dip my toe into those waters and learn about, you know, how do you actually create an environment that becomes more of a permanent culture and self-sustaining rather than, you know, having to start from scratch every spring. So to me, that seems like the best approach for earth-friendly.
Absolutely. I know. I never even heard the word permaculture until I started my podcast last spring. Even though I've, you know, been studying organic gardening and reading Rodale's for years. And me, who knows, you know, maybe I heard it and just like went over my head. But anyway, so do you want to tell us what really inspired you to start using like organic techniques, or is it just kind of the way you talk?
I think I'm just a geek and I like to work with systems, you know. So for me, you know, organic, I think the word, the definition of the word has become, you know, used all over the place now for marketing purposes. And, you know, it loses maybe some of its original impact when you have major corporations doing everything organic. And I start to wonder, well, what does that really mean when you're growing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of acres of something? Although it's certainly possible. So really what inspired me is just looking at, you know, how to use what's out there. It's similar to what I said just a moment ago. We want to observe what's going on and then, you know, try not to intervene in the environment too much so that we get, you know, we have to fight what's already there. So to me, that's my inspiration for using organic. And we'll see how it goes when I expand my garden this year and get more pests. We'll see how closely I can stick to it.
Oh, I think it'll go the other way around. Because, like, I just interviewed Mandy Girth, who's right kind of down, you know, she's in the Flathead. They have Lower Valley Farm. And she talked about how the more beneficials you have going, the number of pests get reduced over time.
Interesting.
So I think you're going to find that will hopefully be your outcome. So how did you learn how to garden organically then? From like reading or on the internet?
Yeah,
or?
I'm really at the beginning of my learning curve. And, you know, one of the benefits of living in the Flathead Valley in Montana is we're surrounded by so many knowledgeable people who are willing to share their information. So I have to say, yes, going to the internet, of course, is a great resource. But still, it's hard to absorb all the information the first day.
Absolutely.
So it can be a little bit intimidating to get started. But I've just found there's something about the face-to-face interaction and meeting farmers locally and picking their brains. People are just so amazingly helpful and excited about helping new gardeners get started in my experience here. So, you know, if I'm thinking about, you know, those of you out there who want to get started, but aren't sure where to start, or not even sure if they have the space to do it, if you live in a more of an urban area, I would say, you know, reach out and connect to people who are already doing it locally, and you can find those folks online. And even if they're not exactly in your area, it's just there's a wealth of information out there. And, you know, the learning face-to-face and asking specific questions based on your specific situation, I think, is a much faster way of getting started than to try to do it and absorb all the information on your own. And also, you know, attending events and being able to talk with people on the phone if you can't see them face to face, that's another way that I think is an advisable way to get started and to learn.
Yeah, and the bonus to gardening is we have events every week because almost everywhere there's a farmer's market that's free you can go to, and the farmers, you know, sometimes they're busy if you catch them when the line's long, but, you know, there's, you know, if you get there at the right time or something, you can usually, they're pretty happy about sharing and letting you pick their brains and telling you about things that grow well in your area or what's, you know, going on in the market or just different you know, when they almost all have websites anymore besides. What was I going to say, though, that you were talking about? So speaking of the Flathead Valley, now my brain's like on overload just coming back from my trip. And like I've done 4 interviews in the last 2 days just out of the blue. Plus, are you going to be at Robin's Seed Fair? Are you having a booth there? Are you going to go? Do you know about it?
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned it. So if for folks listening now, a little backstory here, I was listening to Jackie's podcast several weeks back, and Robin Kelson mentioned that they were going to start a seed swap fair, the first annual one locally here in the Flathead Valley in March, and they needed some volunteers. So I emailed right away, and I was like, hey, you know, I'd love to see where I can help out. And I'm now helping Robin coordinating volunteers for the event. So on that note, if you happen to be in this local area, feel free to reach out to me on the contact form on planetbeeharvest.com. If you're interested in volunteering, I still have room for a few more spots. And it should be a really fun event. And the more people who pitch in, the more everybody else will get a chance to enjoy it. So it's been a really, thank you, Jackie, for having Robin on. And it's been a great group of people coordinating this event. Really, really have enjoyed helping, you know, make the first one go smoothly. And we hope it does. So it's on March 19th. If you're interested in coming, whether you volunteer or not, and it'll be held between 10 and 1 at the Flathead Valley Community College in Kalispell. So, and if you want more information on all the workshops and everything else that's going on, you can go to the website, which is freetheseedsmt.com. Or you can search on Facebook for Free the Seeds Kalispell, and you should be able to get the skinny on what's happening on March 19th.
Yeah, And it's incredible. I can't believe how far it has come since Robin and I talked on that podcast that day. The presenters are going to be amazing. She has got the workshop. It's going to be hard. And I think one of the great things about it is only from 10 to 1. So it's only 3 hours. It's a very short piece of time that day. It's going to be really hard to choose what you want to go to. She's got tons of stuff for kids to do. It's just going to be fantastic. And what was I going to say? If you're not in Montana and you're thinking this doesn't apply to me, there might be one going like that on in your area that you want to attend. If you Google some kind of seed fair or, you know, planting fair, because it's not just going to be seeds. If I understand right, there's also going to be like starts there that people can take home and maybe even like tree grafting and like just all sorts of cool things. And then, or you might want to start one in your own community. Like I was telling Robin about, I have these cute Earth Day puppet shows, and she was started talking to me about an Earth Day event. So, you know, Earth Day's coming up. You might want to think about that. Anyway, back to the show today. We're talking about, tell us about something that grew well. Tell us about your business. Tell us about sprouts. If people are like, what are pea sprouts? What are sunflower sprouts? Because I'm sure some people are like, sunflower greens, sunflower sprouts, what are those? And you said that you started doing them at home first. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what all that means?
Yeah, it's funny. The one thing I learned working the first year of the farmers markets last year was, hey, I see these growing under my bird feeder. So sunflower greens they're a microgreen. Essentially, I take organic black oil sunflower seeds. You probably don't want to use the ones that you use for your birds unless they're just plain organic seeds. Make sure that you get one, you know, the seeds, if you're going to purchase them, that are meant for growing microgreens, because the ones for birds sometimes can be treated.
Let's step back a second. Where do you get those organic black oil sunflower seeds then?
I've tried a lot of sources. I like Johnny's seeds the best, at least for what they had last year. I mean, they seem to have a very high germination rate and good quality. So that's my preference. But there are a number of other seed companies that do sell. Especially if you're just looking for a small quantity, there are a number who sell online. So if you want to look for sunflower seeds, just search on Google or Bing for sunflower seeds for microgreens, and then you should have lots of resources and kind of can compare prices and all that kind of stuff. So that's where I get them.
All right. I'm going to need to check that out. Being the sunflower girl, my goal, I was just going to plant the regular bird seed ones this year. But then I'm pretty much planting mine to feed my birds. But I might look into getting some different ones for feeding me.
Yeah, I mean, they're really healthy. They're my favorites because the greens taste like kind of nutty sunflowers themselves, but they're filled with all sorts of amino acids. And, you know, I had a kind of tear sheet at my booth with all the list of healthy ingredients in sunflower greens. So it's a really concentrated nutrient source, like so many other vegetables are. But because they're harvested young, supposedly that, you know, keeps, they're not using all their nutrients to grow larger. All those nutrients are still, you know, in the plant. So, and they only take about 14 days from start to harvest. So that's another, for someone who's looking to get started inside, that's another thing to think about. You can do them really quick. You can start batches, you know, every week or so if you want a continuous supply. I originally did it indoors because living in Montana, getting fresh produce all winter can be a little bit of a challenge unless you have a heated greenhouse. So with a little bit of a light, and I just used a regular incandescent light and it seemed to work fine when I was growing them indoors. You can plant them in shallow trays. Some people even just use little bread pans and put about, you know, an inch and a half of soil in there. They don't need a lot of soil. you soak the seeds first until they sprout. Soak them overnight just to get them saturated. Drain it and then wait till they sprout little tails, wetting them every day or, you know, a couple times a day. And then when they have about a quarter inch tail, you can spread those seeds right on top of about an inch and a half of soil and cover it until they root. I weight mine down so that they root straight. As a home grower, you probably don't have to do that. It's okay if they're a little bit crooked. And then, you know, you wait until they're, I like to harvest them young. Some people let them grow really like up to 4 inches. I like to harvest them about 2 inches because I think they taste better and they're nuttier and they're also prettier. They have nice little red stems. So they look nice in a salad. And yeah, that's about it. If you want to do them at home. Now, if you're doing them for growing at a farmer's market, you know, I set up a big grow tent, well, big, like 6x8 grow tent inside so I could grow year round with shelves and T5 lights and ventilation and all that to make sure that the environment stays at the optimal temperature to produce a great product. But for the home grower, you don't really have to worry about all that.
Wow. Okay. There's a whole lot more than I thought. I thought it was just going to be like you put them in a jar with the water and shake them with the, you know, screen thing. And that was it. You actually put these in dirt.
Yeah. So that's a really good point. You can do them as sprouts, which is the technique that you just described. And sprout technique works great for some of the smaller seeds like alfalfa and clover. And that in that case, you just put them in the jar with the screen on top and wet them down and then shake them and then let them grow in the jar. I've done that as well for other types of sprouts. For sunflower greens, I don't like that technique as well. I like it better grown in the soil. One, because it gets more nutrients from the soil. And then two, the pesky thing about sunflower greens is sometimes the hulls stick. So if you had sprouts, it would be hard to, like, you know, very time consuming to pick apart the seeds and sprouts. But if you grow it in soil, then it's easy to just mist the greens and then brush your hand across the top of the plants. And then the hulls fall right off. You may have to pick off a couple of them, but the hulls really are easier to remove. And it's almost impossible if you use the sprouting technique.
Wow. And then now that you're mentioning that, I do remember talking to Sarah Harding from Whitefish, the Buggy Road Farm, who sells microgreens. And she did kind of talk about the difference between growing microgreens in dirt as compared to sprouts.
Yeah. I mean, both are good. It's just some seeds are better for sprouting and some seeds are better for growing in soil. So, you know, just it just depends on the type of seed. If you're looking to sprout in a jar without soil, I would do a search on a search engine for sprouting seeds and look at, you know, like I like clover a lot for sprouting. That, you know, radish is really good for sprouting because their hulls tend to just sink to the bottom when you rinse them off and it's much easier to harvest and they taste great.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, do you want to tell listeners a little bit about eating sunflower
greens? Yeah. So I use them in a lot of things. You know, of course, everybody salad is my favorite, and that's an obvious use. I like to put, I'll just eat a big giant bowl of sunflower greens. I put some raw pumpkin seeds often on top. Those are really healthy and taste great. Just a little bit of olive oil or whatever else dressing you want to put on it. Some people just put a little lemon juice. But, you know, any kind of dressing you like is good. So that's an obvious use. But you can also put them in fresh spring rolls and stir fries. You can use them anywhere you'd use a green vegetable. The only thing is, like in a pasta or a risotto, just put them in at the end because they need almost no cooking at all. And when you just heat them up a tiny bit, they get really vibrant. So for presentation, if you want to impress your guests, that's a good thing to add at the end. And it'll add a little bit of nutty flavor too, which is great.
Oh my goodness. See, I knew you were going to be an awesome guest. All the people are like, I never knew. This is so wonderful. A new green that's easy to make. I can do it in the winter. Just tons of, I can't believe it. I'm not doing this.
Yeah,
I made sunflower sprouts many, many years ago when Mike and I first got married, and I did the sprout thing all the time. And then I don't know why I've even gotten off of it.
Oh, if you're like me, you kind of have your little things that are your favorites for a while and you forget about it and like, oh, I should do that again.
Yeah. And especially sunflowers, something new to do with sunflowers. So exciting.
Especially since you like them. Pea shoots are another one that are great to grow.
Okay, like, I was just going to say, so tell us about the pea shoots now.
Yeah, it's, you know, similar uses of sunflower greens. You can cook them a little bit longer because they're a little hardier, but it's essentially the same process. You soak the seeds overnight, and you're really just soaking the dried peas.
Wait, let's back up a little. Like, what kind of peas? Like, split peas, green peas, sugar snap peas? What kind of peas?
So I use just organic field peas. That's what they're called. You can, again, just do a search. I'm not a very good resource for people who don't have internet, but I'm assuming a lot of people have internet if they're listening to a podcast. If you do a search for pea shoot, sprout seeds, something like that, you'll see your options there. But essentially, they're just dried field peas. I use organic. And then soak them overnight, let them sprout. Their tails can get a little bit longer than a quarter inch, unlike the sunflower. And then, you know, spread them over the soil, you know, cover them up, let them root. And, you know, they sometimes are as quick as 10 days from start to finish. They're a pretty quick grower. You can also let pea shoots grow longer. So I often let mine grow up to 3 or 4 inches because they get these sweet little leaves. And like the sunflower greens tasting like sunflower seeds, the pea shoots have that sweet flavor of pea. So, you know, you don't want to grow them too long because they'll get woody and flavorless. But if you harvest them at between 3 and 4 inches, they have that sweet pea flavor very quickly. So that's another good resource. And, you know, you can use them in stir fries and everything else that we mentioned. You can eat them raw, put them in pastas, all very delicious.
Nice. Okay. I love it. So, do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year? Or is that what grew well?
Sunflower greens, I mean, they definitely grow well. And then, of course, everybody's favorite tomatoes. So I should back up a little bit. The first year for the farmer's market, I focused on the microgreens because I wanted to do something that I knew how to do well so I could sell a great product. And I felt like that was a great way to get, you know, started and get my feet wet. This year, I'm going to be expanding the garden, looking to a lot more vegetables. And last year I did do tomatoes and chilies as well. And tomatoes did amazing until the drought. You know, you recall last summer we had quite a drought.
Yeah.
And then the fires came, and where I happen to be, which is in Kyla, Montana, we were surrounded on all sides by fires. It was really challenging. I said, you know, I had jalapenos growing, and I said I have smoked chipotles on the vine because it was so smoky. So the tomatoes did super well. Unfortunately, I got a big harvest before, at least for my personal use, before the fires and the droughts kind of took over. But I think that from what I've heard from a lot of gardeners, tomatoes often do well unless you get hit by some sort of blight or other disease. I was fortunate enough that I didn't have that happen. And the other thing,
we have a hard time up here getting them to turn red before they freeze. Now we're hoping we're going to get the high tunnels this year, and that's going to help us extend our season. But we rarely harvest. The only ones we really harvest that turn red before we get a frost or the cherry tomatoes.
Really? So I'm wondering, did you start yours inside?
Yeah, Mike usually starts them in February inside, but by the time you can put them out here, because we've never really, I don't know, he's made these little hoop covers before where he'll like, we have, you know, like two pretty deep beds, and he just builds like a little tiny plastic, like a miniature high tunnel kind of greenhouse type of cover that he's covered them with in other years, but you know, we just, I mean, compared to like a lot of the farmers I've talked to on my podcast this year, we don't, but glad to hear that it's working down there. And
yeah.
You know, it's weird. It's amazing how Kyla can be different than Eureka. And even like the farmers, places. Eureka, we're 8 miles south of town and they have 3 weeks on us on either side of the season.
This is microclimate city around here.
It is.
The one thing that I think helped and might help you guys as well, this doesn't work on a large scale farm, but I discovered it because out of necessity. I was researching last year before I started my garden, and I wanted to do everything just in raised beds and containers initially because my soil needed some work before I would plant in ground. So I stumbled across straw bale gardening. I don't know if you know anything about that. Have you heard or talked with anybody about that yet? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this guy named Joel Karsten, he wrote a book on straw bale gardening, and he essentially came on it as someone who had academic background in agriculture, but no money. He wanted to start planting, and he thought, well, why can't I just start with, you know, straw bales, partially compost them, and plant directly in there? And his work took off from that point. I read that, and I was like, okay, you know, I have these raised beds that I want to do to fill soil in these big boxes. It costs a fortune. You know, it's very expensive. So, So I was like, okay, well, I'll try the straw bales in there and put a little soil on top, but just, you know, start with his suggestion. And so he recommends, you know, you condition them for 14 days. And what happens, and why this might be useful for you with some of your tomato starts, I'm not sure, you know, if the high tunnel is going to solve your problem, it probably will. But you fertilize and get the composition started in the straw bales before the planting. And because they're above ground and because you've got heat from the composition, I think you can plant earlier than you would typically here in Montana. Okay. So, I mean, that could be why I started mine pretty early, and I would cover them at night when it got cold. And some nights it got down into the 30s and my tomatoes were fine. So I think because the heat of the composition and the straw is much more than the heat they would have naturally in the soil, that really helped give me an early start. That's my hypothesis. I don't know if it's true.
Okay. I'll have to look into that a little more. I belong to a straw bale farmer Facebook group, but I haven't really gone there very much. So maybe I'll look into that a little more this spring.
What's the Facebook group?
I think it's called Straw Bale Farmers. This woman I worked with last year, Carolyn, she did the whole straw bale thing, and so we kind of followed her, and she hooked me up with that group. But then I don't know. I just didn't. The Facebook group that I go to the most is the Flower Farmers, and then there's a Montana Gardener one, and I kind of, even though I belong to several gardening, those are kind of the two that I mostly go to. I mostly go to my podcasting Facebook group if I go anywhere online, to be honest.
Yeah.
So, but, okay, I'll check into that more and see. And maybe look up that book for Mike, the Joel. What is it, cards, like Cardston? Or how
do you, it's Karsten, and his site is strawbalegardens.com, I believe. And he has those books. And he just came out with a new book, so.
Okay, cool.
You know, sort of, he goes into more detail about, like, how do you because one of the reasons it's not that economical for a larger scale operation is you use the bales once and then you can use them as, you know, sheet mulching or something on your garden, but it's not that reusable. But he talks about how you can regather the straw and rebale it and all that in his new book. So,
Well, that's good. We do a lot of mulching, so with straw. Mike's always wanted to build a straw bale house. That's one of his dreams, one of these days.
Wow, that's ambitious.
Well, he built our house from
Lawrence. Oh, he did.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Yeah, it's amazing what he does. He's the real gardener in the family. Last year, he planted a mini farm. Because, see, our water, and this is why I laugh when you say that, we've had major water issues. We just had a shallow well. We lived for 6 years without water. Then we had a water truck. Then we had a shallow well, so we still had to use the water truck. So 2 years ago, we finally bit the bullet, dug a well 560 feet deep. And last year, it's the first year we really had both wells running. Mike planted this mini farm, and I had a well run out of water. It seemed like every other day. It was like, now, I don't know if that new well had some kind of leak. He eventually had to have somebody come look at it in the fall. I'm hoping, fingers crossed, that that was the issue and that we're never going to have that problem again. Because I just thought, because down at Mandy's, I was like, she has like his, what I call his little mini farm. Their 2 acres is like 4 to 8 times as big as the, and if we ran out of water last year, how would we ever water, you know, 4 times that amount of vegetables? So I'm hoping it was that leak. But yeah, but then again, last year was an incredibly dry year. But are we headed that way? You know, they say the climate just, you know, rose those full 2 degrees last year for the first time that they've been, you know, dreading happening. That's 350.org's big thing is we can have 350 parts per million carbon in the atmosphere, and we broke 400, and 450 is what's going to raise the 2 degree. I think we might have even broke the 450, if I remember right. We're right about, and that's what's going to raise the temperature of the planet 2 degrees, and then you're not going to be able to grow things that have been growing, you know, like maple trees won't be producing maple syrup because they won't get that freeze in Vermont. You know, it's like, right. People are like, who cares about 2 degrees? I like it warmer. Well, you know, these are the things that are going to change.
Well, and I think it's one of my major motivations for starting to put my hands in the dirt. And I think climate change, everybody pretty much agrees, is happening, but it's hard to predict, as you were saying, what the effects might be. It certainly won't be business as usual, but we don't know. And one of the things about decentralizing food production and what motivated me to get started in the first place is we can, you know, on a smaller scale, really look at what works, look what doesn't work, and adjust more closer to real time to climate conditions than any big agribusiness will be able to. And I think it's critical that we start, you know, planting seeds, saving the seeds that did well, replanting those seeds, and creating very resilient local pockets of growth where we can share information about what's working in our local areas, because that's going to change as the climate changes, in my opinion, and I think that's, you know, not a big stretch to say. And, you know, every one of us can participate with, you know, that process, even if you're in an urban area and just have a patio, or you just can grow indoors, or you have a small backyard. Every single person can help figure out what's going to do well in the future so we can feed ourselves as the climate, you know, changes, and, you know, have a positive impact as opposed to just wringing our hands and saying, you know, oh, this is disaster is looming. I'm, you know, kind of agnostic about disasters. I'm just like, okay, this is just how it is right now. What do we do about it? And localizing food production, decentralizing it, I think is a huge thing that each of us can do and participate in to help mitigate some of the effects of climate change.
Beautifully said. And I think you're one of those people who's not only doing that firsthand, but you're also like educating all of us today on how simple just, you know, growing some sunflower greens or pea greens or, you know, can be done anywhere on a small scale and making that change. And yeah, you're right about the local food systems. And, the, you know, that's like probably the second biggest thing I've learned. Like, I had no idea that it mattered where you got your seeds from. Like, I didn't know that it made a difference if you just ordered fresh seeds every year or if you reused those seeds. And, you know, that's certainly my ignorance. But, you know, I'm sure other people are learning. Like, I didn't know it was better to reuse a seed and get it climatized to your... I've just always bought fresh seeds and never even thought anything about it. So I'm sure other people are learning that. Anyway, well said was my point. So tell us, is there something you're excited to do different next year? You were saying you're going to grow more fruits and vegetable or more vegetables to take to the market.
Yeah, so definitely doing that. I'm planning right now, I'm planning a lot of some of the smaller or fast-growing vegetables to start in the hothouse. And if I can get my contractor to speed up, I'm hoping to have my greenhouse done before this month's out. So I'll have more growing indoor area, which really helps with this climate. So I was looking at, you know, things like radishes and baby lettuces and baby carrots for some of the early market offerings. We'll see how that goes. And also I started back in December, I started some artichoke seedlings, which I know are super, they have a reputation for being super finicky to grow and don't really, you know, do well in Montana. But I think one of the advantages of being a small gardener where I'm not dependent, you know, 100% on my garden for my income is I can experiment. So I started 10 artichoke seedlings and I have one left. So, and the one I have left is thriving. So I'm hoping that I can try that as my new plant in the garden this year and let that one go to seed and then replant those seeds next year if it survives that long. So I'm all about experimenting, and I'm, you know, I want to have the options for a greenhouse and other climate control, so I have a leg up on the growing season, of course, but also, you know, it'd be interesting to see if you can get some of the types of fruits and vegetables to grow here that traditionally haven't done well, and save those seeds and, you know, create new crops that may eventually become locally adapted. So I'm excited to try that.
Can I ask, like, how big is your place? Like, is it just a backyard, or do you have a big piece of land, or like how?
No, it's small by homestead standards. It's 10 acres. And most of that is wooded, but it's not heavily, heavily wooded. So you could, you know, potentially continue to grow in the woods, and looking into livestock for next year. I'll definitely want to kind of close that loop, so I have manure and everything else in that area. So some of the more wooded areas would be probably good for livestock. But yeah, my growing area right now is relatively small. And I'd like to keep it small and see how much I can grow, you know, through succession planting in a smaller area, because I'm kind of lazy about getting my garden chores done. I at least I anticipate I will be. So I like to keep everything right, you know, where the lawn used to be is now a garden. And so I can walk right out my door and, you know, harvest vegetables for meals and do my weeding and everything else right at close by. So my vision isn't to do a giant operation, a big farm. My vision is more to see what I can grow in a small space and keep it close to the house, easy access to irrigation and weeding and, you know, where there's good light, and then have livestock in some of the, you know, more wooded areas.
Awesome. Have you read that Jean Martin Fortier's The Market Gardener book?
I haven't. I've heard about it. I haven't read it yet. I'll definitely have to put that on my list.
Yeah, I would recommend that, because that's what he's all about, is growing more in a small space. Okay. Now, I have to say, what's your idea of a small space? Because you mentioned 10 acres, and I know most listeners are like, 10 acres, that's huge. But like, your garden itself, is it like 10 by 40 or like, you know, an acre?
An eighth of an acre? I'm guessing it's about an eighth of an acre. You
that's
know, it's
still
not
a big piece of land to somebody who lives in the suburbs. Like my mom, that would be like her, and she has a huge, you know, corner lot, and that would be like her whole corner lot. That's still a big chunk, but yeah. And then the other thing I was gonna say, let me see, go back. Experimenting, being close by, to me that's essential. And I've always been begging Mike for like a little, I want to call it my kitchen garden, where there's just like the lettuce, the radishes, just the things I put in a salad right outside my door. Because for me, it's still, you know, I come home from work and just my salads, my, you know, I get dinner on the table and salad seems to be an afterthought sometimes, or maybe I'll go in the fridge and think there's salad in there and it's bad, or, you know, or I just didn't. And then I'll be like, oh, I was going to make a salad. And instead of running down, because our garden's kind of like at the bottom of a hill, quite a ways away, it just, sometimes it doesn't happen. Or if I do go get the salad, he's already done long eating and, you know, dinner's cold and whatnot. And so I just really, I think that convenience, ease, close to the house. I always tell everybody my favorite wedding anniversary present for our 14th anniversary, he built me a compost pile right outside my kitchen door. And so I just want a little perfect kitchen garden where, you know, my herb, a couple of herbs and my, mostly my lettuce is right there. So maybe some spinach, maybe some kale. I'm finally like, that's, I'm going to finally plant kale this year. I never grew kale before. And then when I was just in Paris, I had the most delicious baby arugula salad. And also, people have talked about that. Is it MASHE? M-A-C-H-E? I'd never tried, and I tried that over there, and I really, and that's like a little microgreen. That was almost really good. Yep. Is it not? I don't know. It just, it seemed little, and they would have like almost the whole plant in there.
Yeah.
And so those were both, those are two things I'm going to try to, the arugula was just, because usually I think arugula is really strong and I can only put like one or two pieces, but they would have a whole salad of arugula, but they were like little baby, tiny, itty bitty, you know, the size of your finger, not even, yeah, probably the size of your finger with all the out stem, you know, with all the like little outer, I don't know how to explain it, but anyway, enough about me. Tell us about something that didn't work so well this season or didn't go the way you thought it was gonna.
I love little sweet pea flowers. So yeah. I tried several times to start with several different batches to start the sweet pea seeds. You know, they say nick the holes and put them in the fridge and all these other things. So I tried, I think, four different batches. I could not get a single one to even germinate. So I asked, I know local growers who have great success, and they said I'm doing all the right things. So I don't know what the answer is, but I had no sweet peas this past year. And I don't know what that, you know, what the trick is, but there's certainly a lot of information, you know, when you start going down the rabbit hole of how to create a successful crop, whatever that crop is, and some of them are, you know, kind of no-brainers, but the more difficult ones, you get into all these very particular, you know, you have to keep it at this temperature for this long, at this period in its growth cycle, and you know, it becomes a little bit overwhelming. So I don't know that I absorbed all the advice that I should have, but I'll try again.
I was going to say, I've had success just, I put them in the ground, direct seed them.
Really?
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe we just, was too fussy.
Yeah. Just wait till the ground's warm enough. But they do like, you know, they're peas, so they like cooler more than warm. But it seems like, we're usually lucky if we're picking peas the 4th of July, so they should be done by July. So you're going to put them in. I'll have to look and see if I have any records, but I'm pretty sure I've direct seeded my peas.
Oh, really? So I was talking about like
I certainly don't do any of that, putting them in the fridge, that type of thing.
No. But you're talking about peas for eating. I was talking about peas for flowers.
Yes. Yeah, no, the sweet pea flowers, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sure I've direct seeded them. I'll look in my journals and see if I can find anything, but
yeah, let me know. Maybe okay. I'll just do that. Maybe I just got too complicated. Anyway, but that, you know, at least last year didn't work well the way I did it, but maybe this year I'll just, you know, be more hands off and follow my own advice about letting the plants do what they want to do.
Yeah, sweet peas are nice. All right, how about I might skip a couple questions because we're almost at an hour already. What's your least favorite activity to do in the garden?
Since I've been growing on a small scale, I don't have a least favorite. We'll see when cool. I expand the scale. I like all of it. I particularly like, you know, pruning, and I like weedings, you know, but I've had, like I said, a small scale area to, weed. So it really, and then growing in straw bales, you get almost no weeds for those, you know, the ones I did grow in straw bales, which is another advantage of that method. But we'll see. We'll see. I don't have a good answer for that with my limited experience. I just find it all very exciting.
Awesome. I love when people say that because I think that really encourages people who are kind of afraid to get into the gardening thing to do it. How about the best gardening advice you have ever received? I was just thinking this morning, today's my dad's birthday, March 8th. And he
Happy
passed
birthday.
Away a few years ago, but we're still celebrating. And I was thinking this morning, my dad's best advice he gave me was feed the animals first. And I think that's the best advice. Go give the birds their bird seed. Go feed the sheep first. Go feed the dogs first. I mean, it is that, well, he had birds and, you know, the wild bird, you know, he was always putting the bird seed out and then feed the dog and the cat. And then my parents were like the kind of parents that still, you know, sat down to breakfast with, you know, cloth napkins and silverware and they're, you know, would sit together and eat. They, for all four meals, always, all my life, they always sat and ate. Anyway, long story short, what's your best gardening advice you ever received?
I think the most important piece of advice that I have to keep reminding myself is watch your garden, see what happens. There are no negative outcomes, only learnings.
I like that. I always say with computers, there's no computer problems. There's just computer challenges. And it might be a problem today, but it's going to someday down the line when you really need to know that answer fast, it's going to pay off. But yeah, that's great. There are no negative outcomes.
No negative outcomes, only learnings.
I love that.
That's my motto.
That's a great one. How about, do you have a favorite tool? Like if you had to move and can only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
Well, I don't know that this technically falls into the category of a tool, but I love my grow tent. Because if you want to grow all year long, having a place, like I said, it's just 4x8. It was relatively inexpensive to buy on Amazon. I put the shelves in there, put the T5 lights on in there, put in a couple of vent fans to keep the temperature regulated. I have the vent fans plugged into a thermostat, so they turn on and off, you know, based on how I have the thermostat set. So that just gives you a super controlled environment all year long if you have the space for it. And, you know, I put it in my shop, so, you know, it does take up a bit of space, but it's well worth the investment. I just think that is such a great way to, maybe not for the home gardener necessarily who doesn't have the space, it's not that relevant, but if you do have the space, having that controlled environment where you can grow what you want all year long, you know, anything that's relatively small. I mean, I have tomatoes growing in there right now that, you know, they're like the size of marbles, which is exciting in March, you know. So that is one of those tools that I think would, if you can have the space for it, gives you a lot of, a big leg up on success and lots of satisfaction. And, you know, it's easy to maintain. You don't have to worry about bugs or anything like that. So that's my favorite.
Nice. I think that's a great answer. And sure, it counts as a tool. I do have to ask, do you have a tool that you use for cutting, like, the sunflower greens or the pea sprouts that special? Or just use a scissor? What do you cut those with? How do you harvest those?
Just scissors.
Just a scissor?
Yeah, just like a long, you know, you'll see them in garden shops. They have long, thin blades and makes quick work of those.
Okay. How about, so this is something that always gets me. Do you have any tips for eating or harvesting vegetables or fruit on time? Like stuff just always seems to come on all at once for me and I just get overwhelmed.
Yeah, I that was my big learning last year is don't plant everything at once. So this year I've taken a lot of pains to do a spreadsheet and like staggered planting times and when to plant the next succession so I don't have it happen. But, you know, even, you know, I think with that, if you're growing garden of size, you're going to have a lot of stuff. So I'm a huge cooker. I love to cook and preserve things. I've done a lot of I bought a nice dehydrator, which was another good investment. Dehydrated vegetables and fruits from my friend's orchard, and that's a great preserving technique. And then, you know, as far as eating them or harvesting them, I would say the direct answer to that is just plan your plantings ahead of time. Look at, you know, your time to maturity listed on the seed packets. And, you know, it's worth taking the little time and effort to put together a spreadsheet and actually map it out, even though it might be a little bit tedious. I think it'll save that pain later on. We'll see how it goes this year if I'm right.
Okay. Yep. Megan Kane does a great job of talking about being strategic in your garden so you're effective and efficient. She has some like little really cool tools for doing stuff like that, like a garden planner and probably a spreadsheet. And just I know I'm still the worst, and here it is year two, and I'm going into year two and I still have no plan made. I barely looked at a catalog yesterday for the first time. I did grab a bunch of seeds last year ahead of time, that, like, you know, at some going out of business or whatever, you know, end of the year discounts, yeah, seeds. So I do have quite a few seeds ready for this year, but yep, I'm horrible at planning. And I also wanted, this girl Amelia Schimmitz from Billings talked about planting sweet potatoes, and you have to buy these sweet potato slips. And I hope I don't miss that, because that's going to be my, like, your artichokes, mine's going to be sweet potatoes and trying to get sweet potatoes to grow in this. And so I got to go back and listen to her show again and review my notes for that.
To learn if your sweet potatoes do well. That's super great experiment. I love them.
Oh, me too. I'm such a sweet potato yam girl. And so, and Mike loves to grow potatoes. So we'll see if we can make that work. And yeah, she said to get these little slips you get. And she said they look like the weirdest thing when you open up the box. The other thing I'm excited is, like, the funniest thing I think I heard was when Sarah Harding from the Buggy Row Farm came on and talked about the ducklings coming in the mail. The post office calls and said, the ducklings come, and, like, they ship them. And, like I can't imagine ordering a baby duckling in the mail, but we might get a baby duck this year after talking to Sarah. And Amelia. Amelia had this baby little duckling. That was the first one who told me. And then I guess in that garden, the market gardener or whatever, Jean-Martin Fortier's book, he talks about ducks. So we're thinking about getting a little baby duck or two this year to go with our chickens. Okay, but anyway, so secrets for preserving food. Was that the dehydrator? Anything extra?
I have that. The other thing is, a lot of people I hear say, oh, how do you preserve eggplant? Now, I didn't grow eggplants last year, but I did buy them from the farmer's market and preserve them. You know, the best, I love preserving eggplant. The best way to preserve eggplant, in my opinion, is to cube it up into 1-inch cubes, sprinkle it with a little coarse salt, like a kosher salt or any other really thick grain salt, toss it around, put it in the refrigerator, and let the liquid drain out overnight. So you just, like, put it in a colander and then in some sort of a dish so it has a place to catch the liquid. Then freeze it flat once, you know, dry it off after you take it out of the refrigerator after it being there overnight. Dry it off with a paper towel. Freeze it in a single layer in your freezer, and then once it's frozen, you can bag it up. The great thing about that, it takes out the bitterness of the skin, so you don't have to cut off the skin before you freeze it. And then it's like the most amazing substitute for meat if you have vegetarians. And I have, you know, nieces and friends who are vegetarian. So it's a great thing to keep in, like, quart bags frozen. You just, you know, maybe toss it, take it out of the freezer, toss it a little olive oil, put it into the oven and roast it for, you know, until it's soft, I think, you know, 40 minutes or so. And then you can put it into vegetarian chili or ratatouille or something like that. I think that eggplant is a magic plant. And as long as you get that water content out of there before you freeze it, it's like the perfect meat substitute.
Oh my gosh, I feel like I should be paying you $10 for this recipe solution right there. Are you going to write a cookbook? That's been my question, because that's what I had last year were eggplants. And I just, no matter how many I tried to eat, tiny ones, I still ended up with this whole crate of eggplants that I was going to make it into parmesan and it never got made. That was the answer.
Yeah.
Where have you
been?
I think
I stole it, give credit where credit's due, from a 1980s cookbook called the Silver Palette Good Times Cookbook. I think that's where I originally got the idea. That's how they prepare. They didn't freeze it, but they prepare their eggplant that way for their vegetarian chili, which is a great recipe. So just to give credit where credit is due.
Yeah, but the freezing part is just, because other people have talked about freezing it, but nobody gave me to cube it and that I could, and then soak it with the coarse, like I always soak it with the coarse salt when I'm going to cook it, but I never knew that's what I want to do before I freeze it. And just,
yeah, you soak it.
That was awesome.
Just sprinkle it, because the coarse salt will, you know, draw out the liquid. So you don't want to actually put liquid with it. You just to be right. Clear. And then it drains out. Yeah. So you get rid of that bitterness, which is what a lot, if you just freeze eggplant directly, without getting the liquid out, it's bitter when you get, you know, unfreeze it. So.
Oh my goodness. There you go. People are finally going to come to my website just to download that recipe right there. Awesome. Okay. So speaking of eggplant and cooking, is that your favorite? What's your favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden?
Oh, to me, there's nothing better than just a fresh slice of ripe tomato and sunflower green, and some homemade crusty bread with a little salt and olive oil. I think just, you know, when you can get vegetables fresh out of the garden, there is really nothing better. So it's not really a recipe, but it's just a good way to eat fresh vegetables. Other than that, I really like the roasted eggplant veggie chili. So maybe I should post that recipe.
Yes.
On my, I do have a blog in addition to my Planet Bee Harvest is my market site. I have a blog on planetbeegardens.com, and it's just B, the letter B in between, no B. And I posted recipes and other, it's kind of like my little journal, nothing exciting, but maybe I'll post that recipe on there today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and they'll go to your website instead of mine. No, that's great.
No, I'm sorry.
No. Don't even. I'm totally kidding. They're, one of these days I'm going to put something on my website besides just the show notes to my website, and then they'll come. How about a favorite internet resource? Do you have a favorite place that you'd like to go on the internet? You've talked about a few different. Do you just like, I mean, Google and Bing have been answers, but.
Of course, yeah. You know, and YouTube searches are kind of fun too. I like the Modern Farmer website. I like their magazine too.
Ooh, but, I haven't heard of them. Modern Farmer.
Modernfarmer.com. I mean, it's really like hip modern farming advice and stories. I love their writing, and often have great resources, but to me the stories, you know, are really inspiring.
Oh my goodness, your blog is awesome. I've never been there. I love it. Oh, listeners, you got to check out Pamela's blog. It's wonderful. planetbeegardens.com. Perfect. And you can see pictures of everything we've been talking about. Okay, modernfarmer.com. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. And that's another one I haven't been to. I'll have to check that out. What else? Was there another one? Sorry. That's great.
I don't know if it's an internet resource. It's not really technically. But I stumbled across the archives of the Mother Earth News. So they have this bundle that they'll send you on a CD, or I don't know, probably by now it's a USB drive or something like that, where they have bundled all their articles going back to 1970. And, you know, it's hit and miss whether the advice is relevant, but it's, you can search, you know, just because you have that all in one electronic form, you can search all the archives for any keywords that you're interested in. And I've just found it, you know, I mean, sometimes it's, you know, especially the older articles from when all the hippies were starting their own homesteads, they're very entertaining and nostalgic. But sometimes there are really interesting nuggets of advice there too. So that was another one, sort of an off the, you know, off the side road resource that I think has been, you know, interesting whenever, like I went to, I'm starting with bees this year. And so I was able to research all these articles on beekeeping going back, you know, 40 plus years, which I found interesting.
Nice. We're starting with bees this year too.
So, oh, are you?
Excellent. Yeah. We got them last summer, and we got some 2 years ago when they didn't make it through the winter. And so these ones seem to be like out and about and are doing good, I think. So hopefully. And Mike and I just planted a whole bunch of clover we got from Lisa Ziegler, a cover crop for the bees, yesterday. And we sprinkled some clover seeds. So we'll hopefully that'll go. And we also got some buckwheat where I'm not sure where that's going to go, cover crop for the bees to grow some flowers for them so they'll be thriving. How about a favorite reading material? Like, is there a book or a magazine or a website that you can recommend?
Well, I think that the Modern Farmer magazine is fun. The Mother Earth News archive I mentioned, that's also interesting. But I think there are either so many, and it depends on whatever is drawing my interest at the time. But I would say let's just stick with those for now.
Okay. And you gave us that great cookbook too. So since you have a business, do you have any advice for listeners about how to get started?
I think getting your feet wet. If you're not ready to jump into the farmer's market, I mean, I was a little bit intimidated by doing it my first year. And, you know, of course, we in this area, we have so many experienced farmers. And then you have me, this newbie, coming in. It's like, oh, I'm going to do just the same thing you're doing. I felt a little bit, intimidated. But I would say everybody is so, so helpful. And, you know, I don't think that was anything I should have been worried about at all. So if you have the interest in getting started, the great advantage of putting yourself out there as a farmer's market, you connect with lots of other farmers, you learn what the public likes, and if you're thinking about, you know, this is a potential business, it's a great way to do your test marketing and hear from directly from your customers what they want, and then, you know, have the basics of a business set up. But even if you don't want to go that route, you just want to get started, I would say, grow anything that interests you, get started. But I definitely recommend starting with something like microgreens because they're quick growing and you'll feel, you know, gratified by having a quick success. If you're not ready to get started growing, I would say reach out to other folks who are doing things that you think you might like to do in the garden or bees or anything else. And have a conversation with them, see what they're doing, and, you know, pick what resonates with you most. So if you need a real baby step, that's a good baby step to take to get started.
You are just full of tons of knowledge. I can't believe you even hesitated to come on here. I knew it that you would be a great guest, because a lot of times the new people do know more about what the rest of us are feeling. Like, that's, I'm totally intimidated to go to the farmer's market and just, and then I was telling Mike today that one thing I've learned is that for us to drive 45 miles to Whitefish is not really that big of a deal, that lots of the market farmers that I've talked to drive, you know, people outside of Chicago or Jenny Jackson down in Georgia when they started out outside of Atlanta, and just that driving 45 miles to your market is not, it's just something we should plan on and not think that's too far away. And then there's the Eureka market too, but my struggle with the Eureka market's always been, it's been at night. I guess the Whitefish one is probably at night too, right? On Tuesday. Do you do the Whitefish one?
It runs from 5 to 7:30 at night. So it's sort of an early evening.
Yeah. I would rather have like a Saturday morning one. I'm just such a morning girl. Like, I'm usually like, my day by 4:30 in the afternoon, I think it should be dark and time for dinner. Daylight savings and I do not get along. I complain about daylight savings from this Sunday until next November. I'll be complaining about them stealing an hour of my morning light. But that's me anyway. I know most people are like,
I agree with you.
But, you know, when you have to be at work at 8 o'clock, there's only so many hours before. And it's like, it's just light enough to start running before you go to school in the morning or before you go to your job or whatever. And then all of a sudden that great hour in the morning where you could be outside is gone. And, you know, anyway, I'm not going to do my little rant on that. We're going to go to my final question. Ready? if there's one change you would like to see, Pamela, to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Well, I think we touched on this. My big motivation is all about, you know, taking advantage of decentralizing the food production so that we can be responsive to climate change. And we can each do our part, even if you have a New York City rooftop, a tiny yard, and a suburban cul-de-sac, or even a few containers in a windowsill. Starting now and growing your own food, even if it's a tiny portion of it, learning what works, I think, is a great way to make that contribution. And then share that information with other people in your local area. It's a great, great process for connecting to new folks and people who have the climate in mind. You know, I think it brings people together, regardless of where you land politically or where you land socioeconomically. I think it's a way of depolarizing a discussion because we all need to eat. And I think that really can bring communities together and also help with long-term food viability.
Perfect. That was said so well. You've been just the most wonderful guest. Do you have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into that dirt and start their own garden?
I would recommend starting small. I think that's not really a quote, but definitely start small. If you're not ready to start yet, connect with folks who are doing things you might consider. See what resonates with you most and do that.
Perfect. And you did give that great advice right before we got to that final connection, kind of ties right in there. Okay. Tell people how to connect with you again. Give them that great, beautiful blog and your website and maybe your Facebook page.
Yeah. So my homestead site is planetbgarden.com. And you can go to the latest post page for whatever I'm thinking about at the moment. It's kind of random, but there you go. And my market website, if you're in the area and want to see where I'm going to be with my greens and other vegetables, is planetbharvest.com. And finally, if you would like to, if you're in the local area, Flathead Valley, and would like to volunteer for the Free the Seeds event coming up on March 19th, reach out to me on the contact page on planetbeharvest.com. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a big commitment. Even a little commitment would be great. So forward to you guys.
Did you want to say anything about, like, what kind of jobs you still need to fill? Like, you know, greeting people or cleaning up, or like what kind of jobs are you looking for?
Yeah, I think we have the heavy lifting stuff covered already, so that's good news. What we really need help with at the moment is folks who can kind of help the flow of during the event. So if somebody looks lost, you know, saying, oh, your workshop is over there, the one you're looking for, or, you know, we're doing some surveys since it's the first annual event. We want to get feedback so we can make the second annual event even better. So that kind of thing. It doesn't have to be a big time commitment. You know, even if you have, you know, half an hour, an hour during that time and you can pitch in that way, that would be really really helpful. It's a totally free community supported event. So all the help that people give makes the workload lighter for the other folks who are participating and coordinating the event. So sign up. Give me a ring. Send me a note.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you so much, Pamela, for sharing everything. And everybody, go to that planetbgarden.com website. I know you're going to enjoy it as much as I liked, and I'm going to go check it out a lot more. So have a great day.
You too. Thank you, Jackie.
Our first annual Seed and Start Fair called Free the Seeds is Saturday, March 19th at Flathead Valley Community College from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. We'll have 18 workshops, 30 booths, 2 films, lots of kids' activities, 2 roundtable discussions on food resiliency for our community, and lots of seeds and starts for sharing and swapping. Come one, come all. For more information, check out freetheseedsmt.com or check us out on Facebook. You can also call 406-471-0022. It's going to be a great time.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow.